Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Today, we continue our in-depth look into the life of Eleanor Roosevelt as part of our full bio series. All week, we're playing installments of my conversation with David Michaelis, author of the new biography, Eleanor. We left off yesterday with a discussion of the ways that Eleanor really changed the mold for what a first lady could do while in office, providing a model for her successors. Hillary Clinton, for example, has stated that Eleanor was an influence for her when she took up the role. Eleanor Roosevelt continued to defy expectations as the United States entered World War II. Today, we talk about Eleanor as a wartime first lady, her determination to combat anti-Semitism at home and abroad, her dismay at Japanese internment, and her insistence on visiting American troops abroad. Her commitment to combating racism throughout the country was far from a lifelong devotion. As we learned in earlier installments, a young Eleanor frequently expressed explicitly racist and anti-Semitic views and consistently referred to Black Americans as darkies. But in her role as First Lady, Eleanor embraced social justice causes and often took a stand where her husband would not. When world-famous contralto Marian Anderson was banned from performing at Constitution Hall in Washington, Eleanor publicly announced her resignation from the organization responsible for the racist act, the Daughters of the American Revolution. Privately, she told the president of the DAR, quote, "You had an opportunity to lead an enlightened way, and it seems to me your organization has failed." With the support of Eleanor and FDR, Marian performed an outdoor concert instead on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Though Eleanor was not there to witness the concert, the event later became known as the first civil rights rally. That was an instance where Eleanor's views were aligned with her husband's. This would not always be the case, as David will explain. But first, we begin with a story that demonstrates Eleanor's power at connecting with everyday Americans, especially soldiers. Realizing she had this skill set helped Eleanor figure out where she would fit in her husband's administration. Here's the author David Michaelis setting the scene.
The classic earliest thing that made her, I think, herself realize where she was going to fit in was very early on in the first, in the spring. FDR was inaugurated on March 4th, right in the middle of '33, in the middle of the banking crisis. The first time you really see Eleanor emerge was actually in May and June of that year, where a second bonus army, U.S. veterans, not being paid their bonuses, veterans of the First World War, men who had sacrificed for their country, who were invalided, who were wounded, who were coming to Washington to get their bonus. They had been treated by the Hoover administration just before FDR had come in. They had been treated as criminals. Hoover had gotten General MacArthur, General Eisenhower, to attack these veterans, these U.S. veterans, on the Mall, in their camps in Anacostia, burn their camps down, routed them out of the city, and shots fired, the whole works. Second Bonus Army comes in June of '33. FDR is now president, and Louis Howe said to Eleanor, "We're going out to the camp, and you're going to go talk to them." And she said, "What? You know, what would I possibly have to say? How could I do that?" And he said, "Look, we're going, and you're driving." And they drove across the Anacostia, and they drove to the camp. And Louis Howe, he's kind of like one of these figures out of a Frank Capra movie. He turns to her and he says, "I'm taking a nap in the back seat. You go ahead into the camp." So he sends her in, and in she goes. And almost immediately, there's a line of men there's a chow line, men waiting in line for food. And she goes up to the first one and asks his name and starts to talk. Within an hour, a group of U.S. veterans is surrounding her. They are singing songs of the First World War together that she remembers from the Army canteen she worked in. She has hundreds of men in the palm of her hand. She is laughing. They are laughing. She's taking names. She's right on everything that they need and want. And she's taking it back to the White House right now. And she leaves and she goes back. And the headlines in the Washington, D.C. papers the next morning are a quote from one of the men: "Hoover sent the army Roosevelt sent his wife. And so she became this figure, and people saw themselves in her, and they saw their mother and they saw their wives and sisters. And she was a female figure, but she also was always in a man's world. So she carried something that no other woman of the time carried, which was a kind of passport of influence and power that just never had existed before for a woman in America.
We've talked a lot about Eleanor's travel and her ability to reach out to people. And during World War II, she was insistent that she visit troops overseas on the Pacific front of the war, despite the fact that her husband thought it was incredibly risky. Why was this so important to her, and what did that trip accomplish?
It was incredibly important to her because the men in the Pacific were detached in certain ways from home, in ways that soldiers in Europe fighting against the Nazis, fighting from D-Day on to Berlin, were far more connected to the United States and to home. Men in the Pacific were way out there, and to go there and to bring the spirit of home and of the sense of you're not forgotten, you're not lost here, you're not. The Pacific War was so much more violent and so many more casualties on certain at Iwo Jima, in certain battles, Guadalcanal. There was so much more bloodshed. There was so much more horrific violence. The enemy was such a different kind of enemy, and it was so clear that American servicemen were doing something they had never been imagined they would be doing, or really had been trained to do. Even the Marines were shocked by what they were seeing. And Eleanor arriving was both comic. These were men suddenly on islands, you know, stripped to the waist, waiting and hoping and praying that the person, that the rumor about the VIP coming was going to be that oomph girl, Ann Sheridan, or Betty Grable, or, you know, one of the pinup girls. Suddenly off the DC-3 would step a woman in a grass skirt, and it was, by God, Mrs. Roosevelt. It was the president's wife. And she always felt she had disappointed them, but in fact, they loved her. And they named their planes after her, and they were utterly smitten by her. And she went bed to bed to bed in hospital after hospital. She went man to man to man to man. She took messages home. She knew their hometowns. She had been now first lady for nearly 12 years. She knew a lot of places in America. And when a man said he was from, you know, Muncie, Illinois, she'd been to Muncie. And she'd say, I know your town. And she had a connection with these men because she had sons who were soldiers fighting in the war. Her sons were among the bravest of soldiers. They were real Roosevelts. They fought for the... They were so badly criticized as children of the White House that it always bears remembering how courageous and truly brave Eleanor Roosevelt's sons were in the war, each one of them. And I feel very strongly that her ability to be a mother to all soldiers and all men was coming out of course, her own personal feelings as a mother for her own and for the dangers that her own sons were facing. That trip, which was forbidden by Admiral Halsey, was FDR, you know, was reluctant to send her. She had to pay her own way, actually, even to the West Coast before she was sent on the troop plane down to the Pacific Islands. They all thought she was going to, that she was should not be there. And by the time she left, Admiral Halsey said, I've never seen a braver person, and no one in my combat area could have done so much as she did while she was here. Two things, though. She took a very hard line at one point in the war that I think is really worth remembering, which is that there came a point where in the desert, Arab forces meted out in inhumane deaths to American airmen. They were tortured before they were killed. And Eleanor's response, casually and unofficially, to her husband and to the group in the White House as this news came in was, we should bomb all of Arabia. And people around her, especially her husband and others, Harry Hopkins and others, were surprised that she would take such a hard line. FDR felt there was nothing to be gained by randomly bombing nomadic tribes, which is how they saw the Arab forces at that time. But Eleanor was staunch about this. She was, these are American lives. These are American men. Nothing like this should ever happen again. And it was more like, she was more TR. She was more Theodore Roosevelt at that moment than Franklin Roosevelt. And you saw this later in her life when she was dealing with the Soviets, this kind of very strong hard line. It's what made her such a good anti-Soviet cold warrior. It also was tempered, in her case, by extreme compassion and humanity, and not simply being a hardliner. But she could take a hardline, is really what I want to say. She was very tough, and she was especially tough on the worst mistake FDR ever made and the worst mistake our government made until its recent years, when FDR issued an executive order interning Japanese Americans after the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
That was my next set of questions. You know, we've been talking a lot about what Eleanor did overseas, but back here at home, her thoughts on a couple of things, a couple of different orders by her husband. One was the internment of Japanese Americans, and the other was her intervening on behalf of refugees from Europe and what was happening in Germany. Where did she stand on these issues, and how much of an impact did she have on FDR?
The internment of the Japanese, as I said, was an executive order. It was opposed by members of the Roosevelt administration, notably the Attorney General, Francis Biddle, who said to FDR, if you try to take American citizens, American-born Japanese, and put them in concentration camps, taking away all their, stripping them of their civil rights and civil liberties and property and everything that makes them a citizen of the United States, you will be creating a precedent that can be used in the future by other presidents. That may be the worst thing that will happen here besides the cruelty and inhumanity itself. Eleanor focused on the cruelty and the inhumanity, and she could hardly believe it. She dreaded this. She dreaded especially that she could see she was not going to have influence on it happening. She tried, in fact, to find ways to at first dissuade FDR, but knowing that she couldn't, she publicly had to support him, although she made clear that she was, and she was by then the co-director of the Office of Civil Defense, the first lady to take on a government, a role in the government. And after Pearl Harbor, after the bombing at Pearl Harbor, she was the first U.S. official on the air the day of Pearl Harbor, the day before FDR made his declaration of war to Congress. Eleanor spoke to the people, and she spoke very clearly about what was happening and told Americans the truth. And she put her trust in Americans, in her fellow Americans. And she was an inspirational and clear voice for people on that terrible day. She went to the West Coast immediately with Mayor LaGuardia of New York, who was the other director of the Office of Civil Defense. And one of the things she did right away was she went up and down the coast visiting Japanese American communities, showing her solidarity, showing that she believed in their citizenship and their Americanness and their loyalty. There were calm heads that were trying to prevail, and Eleanor's was one of them. As the internment continued and as it took its final shape of concentration camps in Arizona, in California, in Colorado, I think it was 13 in all, she was called by FDR when the conditions at one of the camps, the Manzanar camp in California, was reached such horrific proportions and was not riots, but terrible unrest began to break out, that she was then called in by FDR to go and be the government official who would represent the president and go to the camp and calm nerves. And that is exactly what she did. She constantly faced down the real, actual results of her husband's decisions. She was the one who helped various different groups of refugees, only by the hundreds coming from Europe instead of the thousands that could have been saved or the tens of thousands. And the fight she fought against the visa czar in the State Department, a horrific anti-Semite by the name of Breckinridge Long, was personal and it was professional too. But she constantly kept up a stream of requests, and she disturbed the peace. I mean, she did fight the fight to bring as many refugees from Europe as she could, and it was a losing battle.
FDR died in 1945 before the end of the war. How did she react to the death of her husband and pulling out? What did that mean for her future?
You know, her relationship to her husband at that point was one of great concern and dispassionate and detached love. She loved FDR, and she knew she loved him and that she loved who he was. And she always said, actually, I've always felt safer in the White House knowing that Franklin was president. And I think she believed in him despite their differences on this issue or that issue, this humanitarian moment, that crisis. She knew he, on bending the bigger arc of justice, on bending the bigger arcs of the Depression and of the war, both of which Franklin Roosevelt was right about, and was nearly at the point of victory at his death, she knew that what he had done was good and great, and that every single thing she would do for the rest of her life, she felt would be as nothing compared to what had already been done during the Roosevelt administrations. She looked out from a train that took her from Warm Springs, Georgia, where the president had died, that she had flown down to Warm Springs. And she looked out at the world and recognized that America was not just grieving a person or a president, but grieving a loved one, a member of their family, grieving someone so close and dear to them that it was a national trauma. And she could only help in her own grief for the loss of the world that he would have made, she felt, better by taking care of others. And the first person she took care of was the next president of the United States, Harry Truman, an extremely uninformed, meaning FDR had not even told him about the existence of an atomic bomb and had not told him this and that and the other thing about what was going on in the waging of the war in the White House. But he was the vice president, and he was on his way in the Senate to a meeting when he was summoned, and he got himself to the White House and came up to the second floor. And there stood Eleanor with Steve Early, the press secretary, and Anna Roosevelt. And Eleanor came forward and said, Harry, the president is dead. He said to her, Mrs. Roosevelt, I'm so distressed. What can I do for you? And she said, no, Harry, what can I do for you? For you are now the one in trouble.
End trouble, and the end of the war was coming. That was part four of my conversation with David Michaelis about his new biography, Eleanor, about the life of Eleanor Roosevelt.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.